We're back on golf today. 5 years after winning the Chevron in 1984, World Golf Hall of Fame member Julie Angster did it again, Mission Hills Country Club. This time in commanding fashion, beating Joanne Carter and Tammy Green by five for her third of seven major championship titles.
What a career it has been for Julie Angster. 31 wins on the LPGA Tour. The only golfer in history to win two plus majors in a decade for three consecutive decades, inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame in the year 2000. And the legend that is Julie Angster joins us now. And Julie, you know you're a legend when you actually have another major champion holding the camera. I believe Pat Hurst is holding your phone for you right now.
Yeah, Pat's my co-captain here today. So she's holding the camera. She doesn't have quite steady hands. It's jiggling a little bit, but she's doing okay.
They were steady enough to win the Chevron herself back in 1998. When you won your first major championship back in 1984, Julie, you'd only turned professional 8 months before. Were you surprised by how quickly success came at that level?
Yes. I mean, I really didn't even start golf till I was 15. I don't remember much, but I do remember that, you know, I went up in a playoff against Pat Bradley, and I was shaking in my boots most of the whole time. But, you know, looking back on it, you only have certain times to really win majors. And when you're there, it seems like you're going to have a lot of opportunities to win majors. But looking back on it, I was really happy that I took advantage when I had the chance to win majors, because, you know, in your career, everybody kind of bases your reputation and your resume on majors. So, I've been able to win seven of them, and, none of them are easy, but I still kind of shake my head that I won seven of them.
Well, I imagine it's hard to win a major when you're shaking in your boots the way you described it. But you're right. I mean, Pat Bradley already was a two-time major champ when you met her in that playoff. Do you recall the mindset, how you kind of tried to stay in your bubble, stay in the process? Did you kind of like not look at her? How'd you handle that moment?
It's hard not to look at Pat Bradley. Pat was the ultimate competitor. She wasn't warm and fuzzy. She's super warm and fuzzy now, but she was a competitor. And it was the 15th hole at Dinosaur, which is like driving it down a narrow one-way road. And she won the flip, and she kind of hooked it left. And I know I was too nervous to go get my three wood, so I just hit driver. I ended up hitting it down the middle. And Pat, being the ultimate scrambler, I don't know how she did it, but she ended up making a bogey, and I ended up two putting for par. So, it was a great start to my career. Every time I see Pat, I kind of give her a little wink.
Julie, you won two majors after your 40th birthday. I actually think you turned 40 during the week of one of those major victories. Is that the kind of longevity you expect to see in the game going forward? Because it does seem as though a lot of the top players do tend to step away a little bit earlier.
Yeah, definitely. I think since I started so late, and I always felt like I had to, catch up. I think a lot of these girls, these young women, are starting so early and they play all around the world. I mean, they're kind of like professional amateurs. And, you know, when they get to the tour, they've probably played for, 10 years already, just travel around the world. And I don't know. I just think there's more to life out there than golf. I played all sports. I ended up having my kids when I was 30 and 34. I traveled with my kids. I had other things in my life going on, and I do have a really strong passion for the game of golf. I love to play. I love the banter of golf. I love being out there, having fun and giving everybody some grief.
Julie, you won 31 times, seven major championships. As you noted, I'm curious how much you worked on the mental side of the game, because it seems like players across sports these days, it's not just the work on the driving range or in the gym, it's the mental work as well. Did you have a specific mental coach or mental pathway, or did you just kind of figure it out as you went along?
I just figured it out as I went along. I mean, if you look at my career, I had a lot of ups and downs. And, you know, when it's down, it's really hard to get back up. But, you know, I'm pretty persistent. And I just, you know, thought I could get back to where, you know, I could be winning tournaments again. You know, we really didn't have, you know, mental coaches or physios or nutritionists or, you know, we just kind of went out and played, and that's kind of my generation. Now it's, you know, a bigger business, you know, more money, and everybody seems to have teams. But, you know, we just kind of figured it out.
We saw you out there for one event last year, Julie. You actually played pretty well, almost made the cut at age 65. Are we going to see you out there this year?
I don't know. Probably not. I don't know. I might play the Dow with Angel Yen. I'm going to just see how my game is. But the reason why I did that, I just wanted something before the U.S. seniors. You know, that's kind of where I'm at right now, just playing in the senior tournaments. You know, I got two grandkids right now, and that's a lot of fun. It's kind of a different chapter in our lives, and we're enjoying it.
You know, Julie, there will be a segment of the viewers that are always going to hanker for the California desert and miss the old Dinah. But can you put in a positive word or two about Houston and Memorial Park and kind of the evolution of the Chevron and maybe what you're seeing?
Yeah, I mean, Mission Hills is a great golf course, and it's a championship golf course. You know, I have a lot of great memories. I think everybody has, in my era, has a lot of great memories. But, you know, I think it ran its course, and I think Chevron has done an amazing job, you know, with the history, bringing back the past champions, also, you know, encouraging the juniors here from Houston. We did a little junior legends tournament yesterday. The players are treated amazing. The priority on player hospitality is amazing. Yeah. I really like Memorial. I think it's a great golf course. You know, it's right in the heart of the city. I think they're going to get some, you know, a lot of families out here watching, a lot of young kids out here watching. And I just think it's a really good move for the Chevron. And being a major, I think it's a great golf course. So, you know, the men play the Houston Open here. It's a second shot golf course. You're going to have to be precise on your iron shots. So I think this is a really good move for the tournament. Yes, I miss Mission Hills, but, you know, we evolve. You know, the tournament evolves, the LPGA is involved, and I'm looking forward to watching this weekend.
It's a great week ahead, and it's always great to catch up with you, Julie. And we're going to let Pat go rest her arms now because it's starting to look a little bit shaky on the camera, but thanks so much for the time.
All right, thank you so much, guys.
Welcome back into Hour 2 of Golf Today. Eamon Lynch alongside Damon Hack. The Chevron Championship, the first major of the women's golf season, starts this week at Memorial Park in Houston.
Yeah.
The men's Houston Open on the PGA Tour was there a few weeks ago. Do you think there are pros and or cons to the potential of the tournament being there? I mean, the infrastructure is there, but what's the wear and tear on the property, I guess, would be my question.
I think there are more pros than cons. In fact, I'd like to see them butt up against each other, back to back and belly to belly, a la 2014 Pinehurst number two, when you had the women and the men back to back. Why not go men, you know, play the Houston Open and then go to the women in the Chevron? Why not do something where you have it back to back, where Houston's already in a lather and excited about professional golf being in the neighborhood for the good of the game? Have the LPGA Tour and the PGA Tour working together on this from a scheduling standpoint to give Houston a little two-week two-step.
That sounds great in theory until Nelly Korda on Sunday afternoon sitting out of Scotty Scheffler's divot from the week before. At least having a month gives the course a little bit of time to recover. But I think there's definitely more pros than cons to it, certainly with the infrastructure being in place, and it's obviously a worthy venue.
Yeah, we'll see what happens with the schedule going forward. As you mentioned, it is major season on the LPGA Tour at long last. The first major of 2026 in the women's game moves to Memorial Park in Houston after being played at nearby Carlton Woods the previous 3 years. So coverage begins on Thursday right here on Golf Channel. As you know, wonderful history, to this event. We go back to 83, the first edition of the Chevron. As a major, the event at the time was played at Mission Hills Country Club, Rancho Mirage. Look at these old pictures. Amy Alcott won by a couple of shots over Beth Daniel and Kathy Whitworth. Then it was 88 when she took the title again and notably launched this celebration, the famed leap into Poppy's Pond after her second win at Mission Hills.
When number three came, 1991, it was a runaway over Dottie Mockery, she was then. Dottie Pepper, the pride of Saratoga Springs. It was an eight-shot victory for Amy Alcott. She made that leap again. That was her final victory on the LPGA Tour. What a career it was. Five majors, 29 victories in total. She was a Rookie of the Year back in 1975 and inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame in 1999. And it's great to have Amy Alcott join us now. Amy, you won the Chevron Championship three times, but that was, of course, back in the days when it was the Dinosaur. Does it still feel like some of that old identity is still attached to this tournament, or does it feel like a completely new event in your experience?
Nice to be with you, gentlemen. It feels like a different tournament, you know. Maybe part of that's age-related, I don't know, but... the original Dinosaur was in Palm Springs, and it was just a very different event. It had a different ambiance, and now it has, you know, a big corporate sponsor in Chevron, which is great, on a new golf course. And it just has taken on kind of a different brand, so to speak.
And Memorial Park is that new golf course. Amy, is it important that this tournament, this major, finds its footing in terms of a location that is more permanent, like Mission Hill was, as opposed to moving around every few years or so?
No, I totally agree with that, Damon. I think that, you know, they appear to have found a home here at Memorial Park. It's a great remodel. It's a very tough course. I played yesterday, actually, here. I think it has a great ambiance. I think it will be a real challenge for these top women golfers of this era. And I think that it just needs to settle in and build what it's, you know, its own history here in Houston with a new venue that challenges the players like this.
And one of the things they've done, Amy, is they're adding a temporary pond close to the 18th green. You, of course, get the credit for starting the Poppy's Pond leap tradition back when you won the Dinosaur. Are you happy to see that tradition continue?
Yeah, I am. But on another side of it, you know, what I did back in 1988, it was my second, at that time, Kraft Nabisco tournament. And it was very organic. You know, it was a moment of excitement for me. I probably have talked about it a million times, why it became such an iconic moment in women's sports, women's golf. And it was very organic. It was a moment of excitement, first with my caddy, and then following in 91 with Dinosaur. And the gallery got behind it, the sports media got behind it, and you know, I didn't know what I was doing then. I was just thrilled to win and have captured the event at that, you know, at that stage of my career. It seems to have become a part of the kind of fabric of this tournament. And if they want to keep it going and they can do it successfully without having it be too staged and whatever, and all the gals hopefully know how to swim. That's a helpful thing. There have been players that have done it that probably need some swimming lessons or, need to jump in a pool and learn the backstroke. But I'm behind. If they want to keep that going, that's fine. But for me, it was something I didn't even think about.
Amy, you've lived a fascinating life, the 29 wins and five majors, of course, the Hall of Fames that you're a member of. I read recently where you were thinking about doing a documentary on your life, someone who's lived through a very you know, important period of time in sports, the growth of women's sports, Title IX, Billie Jean King. What message would you want to send in a documentary on your life?
Well, I've had a really interesting life. I mean, there's aspects of it that are, you know, my parents didn't play golf. I grew up putting and chipping on my front lawn into soup cans at the Alcott Golf and Country Club. I was kind of a homegrown pro. You know, my life sneaking under the fence at Riviera Country Club, where the U.S. Women's Open is, meeting all the movie stars that I did, having the different sponsors, and, you know, I've just had a really interesting life, and I've seen so much change now in women's sports and women's golf in particular. You know, my mother used to have to look under a microscope to the at the back of the sports Los Angeles Times, and the back three names might have been listed. Now it's kind of LPGA is a bona fide sports organization with million-dollar purses and players globally from all over. And, you know, there are things that that are so much a part of the growth of the game. I just have, you know, just had an interesting life that maybe some people don't really know about. And my travels, the people I've met are immense, and the precedents I've played with, and lots of interesting stories. So I'd like to, you know, carry that through and send a message to young people that you can come from anywhere and do anything. And if you reach high, you know, you can make things happen, you know. So, yeah, I think without going into it too much, I think it would be a great story to tell.
You have a wealth of experience accumulated over the years as well, Amy. Do you find that the younger players are seeking you out to try to get some of that, soak that up from you, particularly as the U.S. Open, as you mentioned, heads to your home course of Riviera? Presumably somebody wants to pick your brains before that week.
Not really seeking me out. For example, yesterday on the putting green for my event here, the Junior Legacy, the Chevron Junior Legacy that I host here as a kind of a precursor, I was on the putting green with Leona McGuire, just chatting with her about her game and, you know, just using a couple of things that popped out about slumps and things that I got through in my career that I really didn't talk about very much. I had a terrible problem with the yips. Here I am in the World Golf Hall of Fame, the LPGA Hall of Fame, and I watch people on TV. I had a terrible problem with the yips that kind of defined an early stage of my career, and I found a way to get through it, trying lots of different things that I won't go into now. But, you know, we were just talking about, I mentioned her. When you're on your deathbed, you're not going to be wishing for another golf tournament. It's going to be about smelling the roses along the way, like I told Annika early in her career, and she reminds me of. Just enjoy your life. Don't turn down opportunities that might come your way that might be a little different or off the beaten path, because you never know who you're going to meet, where these things are going to pass for you. And, you know, I think that that's really important. It's as much as it, I've said, as much as it's about golf, it's not about golf at all. It's about, you know, the truth will set you free and live your life and, you know, stay focused, play great golf, and don't have rabbit ears. Don't listen to too many people with all kinds of golf advice and crazy stuff. Know yourself and have a good time.
Amy,
that's what I told
you. It's such sage advice that you give. And for me, for one, I'm so impressed that a player like you, Bernhard Langer, for example, overcame the yips. There are golfers watching this program right now who would love one tidbit from an LPGA legend like yourself that might help them get over the putting yips? I know you don't want to get too deep in the weeds, but is there one piece of advice you could give a struggling putter to maybe move past it and enjoy the game a little bit more?
You know, I was always a great ball striker. Players of my generation on the tour know that. I was pretty brilliant with my short irons. And then I'd have a four-footer and I'd find a way to three-putt it, you know. It's really hard to talk about because I've kept it so private and so personal for so long. And but players who know me kind of know that I probably would have won 100 tournaments. I probably would have been in the Hall of Fame 5 or 6 years earlier. It was something that was very difficult. I tried going cross-handed. I tried like Jordan Spieth looking at the hole. I tried from a psychological standpoint, walking on the green and saying, this green is my friend. It's not my enemy. And I ventured out and I talked to Dave Peltz at one time, thinking that it was technical, but for me, it was emotional. It was my deep expectations is of, you know, of wanting to be successful and wanting something so much that I found a way to freeze over putts. I don't know completely, Damon, what happened along this road. I think going cross-handed was the thing that really helped me the most, because the minute you think about things too much, you're going to find a way to three-putt or jab it or get wristy with it. But I think that was the ultimate thing, going cross-handed, feeling my left hand low, the blade was going to the back of the hole. If it wasn't a tournament, I would have, I could putt and shoot, you know, 65s all day long. But the minute the gun went up, but I did find a way to win. I used to have caddies tell me, Alcott, you have a will that is just unbelievable. You find a way to do it. So it's something that I kind of got through over time, and putting less pressure on myself sure certainly helped.
Amy, you've shown so much grit throughout your life. You're a great champion, and more importantly to us, a great friend. Hope you're able to enjoy this week and smell the roses a little bit in Houston. Thanks so much for the time today.
Thank you, guys. Always great to be with you.
Back on golf today, take you back 3 years ago to the RBC Heritage. Matt Fitzpatrick won this tournament, beating Jordan Spieth. The three-hole playoff stuffed his approach to a foot to seal it, 63-68 on the weekend. Then yesterday, more playoff heroics from Matty Fitz. Took down the world number one to win a tournament he absolutely loves for the second time. Now a four-time winner on tour, up to three in the official world golf ranking. Hilton Head, Harbor Town, special place for Matt, who grew up vacationing there with his family, including his younger brother, Alex. Now able to celebrate alongside mom and dad, Russell and Sue. Wife Catherine was there. They're expecting the couple's first child. Todd Lewis and Golf Channel senior writer Brian Lavner join us now. Tia Lou, a lot of talk this year from Brian Rolapp, the CEO of the PGA Tour. We've got to go to bigger towns, bigger cities. Something to be said for Harbor Town and the noise and the strength of attendance we saw this past week.
Yeah, and I understand Brian Rolapp and his staff and wanting to get in bigger markets. We've talked about this a lot, that the PGA Tour annually visits only four of the top 10 television markets in the country. However, I hope it's not a broad stroke thing. I hope that they look at each and every tournament individually and make a decision as to whether that tournament belongs there or not. And I say that because the RBC Heritage is a phenomenal gift to us as golf fans. I mean, first off, look at the the players that have won this tournament, starting with Arnold Palmer, Jack Nicklaus, Hale Irwin, Tom Watson, of course, Davis Love five times, Scottie Scheffler. So it's an elite golf course that Pete Dye has designed that the players love to play because it makes you, it forces you to be an artist and not a technician. Secondly, the crowds there are phenomenal. It's very much supported in the state of South Carolina and that region. It's contributed over $61.8 million to charities. The vistas are fantastic. It is a gem on the PGA Tour schedule, and it obviously produces some thrilling finishes as well. So I hope the PGA Tour smartly keeps that tournament there. Sure, it's technically the Savannah, Georgia market. That's market 108. But let's not forget, the week prior, we were in Augusta, Georgia. That's TV market 84. And we've had two of the best tournaments we've seen, obviously, on the PGA Tour calendar this year.
Lav, as Todd says, it was a great tournament yesterday with Matt Fitzpatrick taking down the world number one. Who's the rightful world number three at this stage? I mean, it's fairly indisputable who number one is, who number two is, but we've had Tommy Fleetwood, Justin Rose, Cameron Young, Matt Fitzpatrick now all occupying that number three slot. Is that just kind of the recency bias temperature check of who's hot this week?
Yeah, I think that's probably fair to assume, Eamon. And I would put Cameron Young and Matt Fitzpatrick sort of in joint third as the third best player in the world. I do think Scottie Scheffler is a tier unto himself. You look at what he's accomplished in 2026, even though he is maybe not playing to the standard that we've grown accustomed to since he really burst on the scene in 2022. From a strokes gain perspective, he's at least in a better spot, Scottie Scheffler is, than he was at this point last year. And obviously it turned out okay in 2025 with two major championships as well. Rory McIlroy, I think, is a historic figure in the game, just won the Masters. Those two players have clearly separated themselves. And that's a little bit of a hodgepodge. Matt Fitzpatrick, certainly on certain golf courses, he's going to thrive. Cameron Young, I think, has established himself over the past 12 months as a serious, serious contender. And then you also can throw in a Xander Schauffele, a Tommy Fleetwood, a Ludvig Åberg, if he could close out some tournaments as well in 2026. That's why I think the rest of the season is so compelling as you try to make a case for who could potentially be the PGA Tour Player of the Year.
Lav, back to you for a moment. You were on the Golf Channel podcast with Rex Hoggard. How are you classifying the future of LIV Golf when every 5 minutes there's a different story and a different thread to pull?
Yeah, it certainly is interesting. And the three of us were on Golf Central last Wednesday when the news was breaking, first from the Financial Times, the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, that the Saudi PIF was on the verge of cutting off its funding to LIV Golf. The major news development, I would say, in the intervening days was Scott O'Neill inadvertently on the television broadcast confirming the reporting that the PIF is close to pulling the funding after the season, will pull the funding after the season. A generous interpretation of that is that this is the beginning of the end, unless there are some outside suitors who want to invest in a product that right now has torched through more than $5 billion with little to show for it. And as Rex and I talked about on the pod show that aired on Monday, it's been a very odd year because you've had big name winners with Jon Rahm, Bryson DeChambeau, even Anthony Kim coming back from the dead, Adelaide, South Africa have resonated internationally. Sponsorship is up. Ticket sales are up. You have Scott O'Neill claiming that LIV is at the best stage it's ever been, period, end of story. However, he now is conceding that he, quote, has to work like crazy for the remainder of the year to keep it going without the PIF funding. And so I think we're going to see, as golf fans, as golf observers, a lot of gaslighting over the next couple months because some of the statements he's making are incompatible with the financial reality that the LIV now finds itself in.
Gaslighting from LIV. Who would ever have thought that one, Lav? Todd, Brody Miller reported in the New York Times this morning that Bryson's team met with other tours at the Masters to probe his alternatives if he were not to go back to LIV. That was, of course, just in the context of his contract being up this year. Do you think, given the developments of the last week, that pretty much every player on LIV at this point is at least going to have to be thinking what their alternatives are?
The short answer is yes, Eamon. I mean, I didn't attend Harvard Business School, but if you're hemorrhaging close to $6 billion a year and you can't get any commercial traction in the United States and the ratings compared to the PGA Tour are a fraction, yeah, I might be looking for another job. I might be dusting off my resume. So I think all the players on that tour are thinking, well, what's going to be next? I mean, look, if everything that I mentioned in regards to this business model, and I've talked to a lot of people that are way smarter than me in the business world, and they said that this just is not a product that is sustainable under this format that they have. It wasn't, you know, we all went into kind of DEFCON 1 last week, but this is not surprising to us. We feel like this is inevitably going to happen. And I'm sure the players are feeling the same way. This has been a vanity project for Yasser Al-Rumayyan and the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia, and it is failing financially from a business perspective. So what happens next? Well, if you're a player, you're like, man, where do I go after this? What's my eligibility moving forward? If you're Bryson DeChambeau, how much leverage do you have now with the real possibility that the Public Investment Fund is pulling out? So yes, I wouldn't say they're panicked as far as players go on LIV Golf, but concerned for sure.
Lav, how much of an instigator / potential protagonist that may determine the future of LIV Golf by his own decision-making is Bryson DeChambeau, who said he's dealing with an injury, may or may not see him at the LIV Golf event in Virginia? Am I overstating his power in this potential future of this tour?
It is interesting, and just to follow up on Tilu's point with the Athletic report from Brody Miller about Bryson and his team meeting with potential tours to at least explore a little bit of exit ramps. Like, that's just smart business. This is a player in Bryson DeChambeau whose contract is expiring with LIV at the end of the year. He has made no bones about it. He has at least contemplated a competitive future in which he's only playing the major championships and also making content on social media. I think it would be irresponsible for him and his team to not know what his options were going to be. The wrist soreness is really interesting, and Rex and I kicked this around as well. I think it's sort of akin, or you can liken it to maybe an NFL player who tweaks his hamstring in week 14, and he's playing for a team that's just playing out the string and maybe playing for 2027 and beyond. Is he all of a sudden going to push it? Is he still going to support his team, support his league as it relates to Bryson DeChambeau? Is he going to be financially, competitively motivated to fight through an injury if he is, in fact, dealing with it and kept him out of the final round of a LIV event in Mexico as well? I don't necessarily think that there is an immediate option for him in 2026. I'm not a lawyer. This is roughly speculation, but there are contracts involved as it relates to the LIV Golf players, and the PGA Tour, I think, would be very wise to tread carefully as it relates to interfering that with any sort of returning member program. Keep in mind, Brooks Koepka was offered that deal. It was a finite amount of time, and it had to happen before the LIV 2026 season. So I think we're looking at conversations at the end of this year for 2027 and beyond.
Oh, there was an amusing little interlude earlier this week at Harbour Town. Max Homa said that he thought Sergio's temper tantrum at the Masters was a bad look, made the golfers look spoiled. Max himself threw a club in frustration, which, it has to be said, with Max is an anomaly. He doesn't do that, whereas childishness is the one constant of Garcia's entire career at this point. But how much of that should the tour actually seek to legislate or control? Does it actually engage fans more when you do see players be more authentic and frustrated?
You know, in my opinion, engaging and kind of rolling your eyes at them are two different things. I do feel like there is a code of conduct that the players, these athletes have on the PGA Tour. And I can tell you this, the PGA Tour is paying attention to this. And I wouldn't be surprised if they formulate some kind of code of conduct that's going to be pretty relevant on the tour. And you could see some penalties, maybe even a disqualification, depending on how egregious the action is. So I think this is something that needs to be addressed. I mean, you brought up football. I mean, if there's taunting in football, if there's unsportsmanlike conduct, it comes with penalty. Why should the same not be in effect on the PGA Tour? These guys are held to the highest standard. A lot of kids look up to them and want to be a professional golfer in their life at some point. So when they see clubs being thrown and tee markers being kicked around and drivers being broken on a cooler like Sergio did at Augusta, then they think that's okay. And that's something that we don't need to perpetuate.
Yeah, not
this
a
is why
look.
I do not play golf with Todd Lewis.
We love self-flagellation.
Oh, yeah, it's a hard game, especially for the two that host this show. We appreciate the thoughts of Ryan Lavender and Todd Lewis on this Monday, breaking down the PGA Tour and LIV Golf as well. We're back on golf today. Time now for a Korn Ferry Tour spotlight. Davis Lamb grew up in Bethesda, Maryland, was Maryland's top-ranked junior, played college golf at Notre Dame, had a fifth year at Florida Atlantic as a grad student before turning pro back in 2021, and won twice on PGA Tour Canada in 2023, finishing third on the season-long standings to earn his Korn Ferry Tour card. But he made just 9 of 25 cuts in 24, finishing 120th on the points list to lose his card, but found redemption on PGA Tour America's last year, finishing third on the season-long Fortinet Cup to regain his Korn Ferry Tour card. And then in March, won for the first time on the Korn Ferry Tour, taking the title at the Club Car Championship at the Landings, finished the week 19 under with a closing 68, 4 top 25 finishes on the Korn Ferry Tour for Lamb this season.
Here's the current state of play on the Korn Ferry Tour points list. Ian Holt on top. Blades Brown there coming off a runner-up finish. He's into the top 10 now. 20 players will earn their PGA Tour cards this year. Davis Lamb at number 4 on that list. And we're pleased to have Davis Lamb join us now on Golf Today. Davis, this was the biggest win of your career. I'm curious what the nerves were like going down the stretch.
To be honest with you, I surprised myself a little bit in terms of the nerves. I'm the kind of guy that I've watched a ton of golf in my life. I watch every golf tournament that the Golf Channel airs. And I'm always watching guys in contention and thinking like, man, how are they doing this? I would be a mess. I'd be a nervous wreck if I was in that situation. And then I sort of suddenly found myself in that situation, and I was a lot calmer than I expected. Certainly there was some adrenaline there and some nerves and some excitement, but for the most part, I was calm, cool, and collected. I think this is a testament to a lot of work that I've done with my mental coach, Graham Betchart, about being ready for those situations, because you never really know when they're going to arise. So I felt ready. I felt like I had a game plan to execute, and we went out there and we did a good job with it.
You said you spoke to Graham on Saturday night. What's that conversation like, specifically when you're in contention with a chance to win?
You know, one of the reasons that I've worked with Graham, this is be my fifth year now, really since I turned pro, is our conversations don't necessarily change based on situations. Obviously, different things come up, different thoughts arise, but it's just all about how can we go out there and execute our plan the best that we can. We work a lot on presence, trust, and acceptance are kind of his three main pillars. So we talked through that. How am I feeling? What are some things that may arise and how can we address those? But for the most part, it was just another day in the office.
You feel the pressure to keep your foot on the gas now, Davis, going forward, just to ensure that you don't have to worry or stress about being in that top 20 for tour cards by the end of the season?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think the goal for all of us is to have that tour bound next to our name or sooner rather than later. I had a great start to the season. No super high finishes, but I felt like my golf was very consistent week in and week out. The win obviously puts me in a phenomenal spot going into the rest of the year, but we still have, I think, 15 or 16 more tournaments. So there's a lot of golf left. And like you said, I'm keeping my foot on the gas, and hopefully I can get that tour card before we show up in Richmond for the final.
A lot of golf left, as you said, but do you let your mind drift forward to what it would be like to have a PGA Tour card next year?
Of course, of course. I mean, it's the kind of thing I've been thinking about what it would be like my entire life, and this is obviously the closest I've ever been to it. This kind of comes back again to the work with my mental coach of how do we stay in the present? How do we stay working on what we're doing? Because even if I were to win another event and find myself tour bound with 10 events to go, I still have to play the rest of the season, and I want to make the most complete season that I can. So it's all a matter of staying focused on the current event. We have some time off now. Like Damon said, I got a lot of things to work on as always. So I'm just looking forward to more opportunities to play golf for a living.
Davis, one thing you said after the win was that it freed you up financially. You've been a server, a bartender. What has chasing the dream been like from a financial standpoint? How stressful has it been from time to time?
Certainly is stressful. I'm very fortunate to have a great support system behind me. But it's never a lot of fun when you're playing golf on somebody else's dime. So to find myself in a position now where I've at the very least paid for the rest of my year, it's a super freeing feeling that not a lot of pro golfers in my level get to feel. So I'm very grateful for it. I'm very grateful to the people that have gotten me here. But again, like anything else, being financially comfortable in this game can be a little bit of a trap as well. So I'm just going to go out there and keep trying to do what I'm doing.
Striking, Dave, is that your previous best finish on the Korn Ferry Tour had been a tie for 11th a couple of years ago. Now you're a winner. Has that entirely reset what you expect of yourself for the rest of this season?
I don't think so. I always knew that my game was good enough to hoist the trophy at the end of each and every week. There's a lot of things that have to go right, as you guys both know, for that to end up happening. You know, the difference in golf from a T11 and a win is pretty minuscule when you look at it over 4 days. So I'm really happy to have gotten over that line. Would I like to have a few more top tens under my belt? Absolutely. But I think pro golf, there's one thing I've learned. It's about maximizing your good weeks more than it is grinding out your off weeks. You know, a host of T25s to T11s doesn't do you a whole lot of good unless you're doing it 20 times. You really need to be able to put your foot on the gas when the time is right and make it work. So I'm happy I did that. And I'm, you know, we got a lot more events to try to do it again.
Dave, I'm struck by the guys, you know, throughout the history of this game who have had to take time away from pro golf. Ben Griffin comes to mind. Jake Knapp, you know, was a bouncer at a restaurant. Was there a time where you thought that maybe this path wasn't going to be open to you and you might have to do something else?
Absolutely. There was a time I did a fifth year of college during COVID when my golf game was in absolute shambles. And I really, really considered, had to think about if this was the right path for me. Like I said, I have a great support system. I had a long call that I remember to this day with my coach, John Scott Rattan. And he basically said, hey, man, like we're in a tough spot right now. I get that. But I promise you, you're good enough to do this. We got to put this work in and you just got to trust the process. And I'm happy that I did. But even, you know, I started my pro career on the PGA Tour Canada, and I felt like I had a pretty good season up there in 2022. I made 9 of 10 cuts, and I lost my card. So at that point, it was like, man, what am I doing out here? And I got my card back out there the prior year and won a couple times to get a Korn Ferry card. So that, in my head, was like, well, I at least bought myself a couple more years doing that. Lost my card on the Korn Ferry, had to go back to Americas last year, played well to get my card. Again this year, and you know, now we're in a great spot to move up again. So I like to tell people I've actually never kept my card on a tour before. I've either lost my card or moved forward. So I'm hoping that trend continues and I move on to the tour next year.
Well, no doubt the arrow is pointing up for you, Davis. We appreciate a few minutes. Congratulations. We'll speak to you down the road.
Thank you guys so much.